I have a theory. I think there's a certain discipline size where expertise becomes largely convergent. What I mean by that is that if a field is niche enough, common knowledge is not all that common. It can be difficult to discover the best practices. So practitioners tend to rediscover best practices, not so much through mentoring or instruction, but because we all end up making the same mistakes and kind of blunder our way into a convergent expertise. And I think several of the subdisciplines of river science are niche enough that they suffer from this kind of convergent learning phenomenon, including my particular subdiscipline, which is numerical sediment modeling. A couple years ago, my agency asked me to write some guidance on sediment modeling, so I reached out to the morphological modelers I knew, and in particular, the model developers, the teams who write the morphological modeling code that other people use. And I asked them about common failure modes they've seen and the best practices they teach. And my overwhelming impression from those conversations was that the conversations were overdue. We had all essentially spent a decade or two learning the same principles independently and often the hard way. But this was before I traveled with microphones or developed the eccentric habit of recording my sediment conversations. So the only evidence I have of those conversations is a document I wrote that stuck in its fifth year of the USAIS guidance review process. So when the Corps and the USGS and the Bureau and the USDA and other US federal agencies held their periodic Federal Interagency Sediment Conference last year, I thought I'd try to reproduce some of the value that I got from those conversations by hosting one publicly. I invited three of the model developers that I've learned from over the years to participate in a panel discussion on their lessons learned, not only from developing and applying generalized sediment models, but from the experiences we've all had reviewing how our models have been applied by others, which can be an adventure. These experiences have helped us all develop intuition around some of the common failure modes and corresponding best practices for applying and commissioning sediment models. I think we managed to keep the conversation mostly qualitative, high-level principles that should be useful to anyone who's interested in sediment or morphological prediction or even hydraulic modeling. In fact, I think a lot of the conversation would be just as useful to someone who's trying to decide if they need to commission a sediment model for their project as it would be to the modelers themselves. And the panel was frankly much more popular than we expected. As it turns out, there's appetite for conversations like this. So I turned on the mics and we did a little editing and we're running it again here. And so let me formally introduce our guests. Gary Brown did his graduate work at the University of Florida and works at the Coastal and Hydraulics Lab, which is part of ERDC, the Corps' major R&D center in Vicksburg, Mississippi. He's been developing sediment models for 29 years, including SedLib, a set of sediment algorithms that are called by ERDC's multidimensional adaptive mesh finite element hydraulic model called ADH or adaptive hydraulics. And Gary's worked on large multidimensional sediment models of rivers, including significant swaths of the Mississippi River and several estuaries, including San Francisco Bay. Alex Sanchez sits in the office next to me. For the last 9 years, he's worked here at HEC and has spearheaded the work to add 2D sediment to HEC RAS, which includes a novel formulation to the subgrid approach. But actually, Alex started developing sediment models at ERDC's Coastal and Hydraulics Lab, where he worked for 8 years before that, working on the coastal modeling system, which is still used by the Corps of Engineers for coastal applications. Alex trained and mentored while at ERDC and during his PhD studies at Ole Miss with Dr. Weiming Wu, now at Clarkson University, who was just a great sediment mind and modeler. Blair Greiman got his PhD from the University of Iowa and worked for the Bureau of Reclamation's Technical Service Center in Denver for more than 23 years before his recent move to Stantec. While working at the Bureau, Blair led the development of SRH-1D and applied this model to a range of projects, including the Mantilla and Klamath Dam removals, the San Joaquin Restoration Project, and reservoir fletching events in Bureau reservoirs. Blair and I have actually taught several classes together and also spent some memorable time together in Southeast Asia predicting the impacts of dams in the Mekong watershed. Finally, we were lucky enough to have Doug Shields moderating this session, so you'll hear from him in the breaks between the subtopics. Dr. Shields worked for 20 years at the Sedimentation Lab of the Agricultural Resource Center in Oxford, Mississippi, and 10 years at ERDC, and has taught at both Tennessee State and Ole Miss, and we're fortunate to draw Doug as a moderator. Now, one of the issues with any podcast featuring N greater than two speakers is that it can be difficult to keep the speaker straight. So after Doug and I introduce the session, you will hear from Blair Greiman, Alex Sanchez, me again, and Gary Brown in that order. I'm Stanford Gibson, the Corps Sediment Transport Specialist at HEC and on the HEC RAS team. And this week on the RSM River Mechanic Podcast, we wrap up our two-episode modeling mini-series with four model developers talking sediment modeling failure modes and best practices.
This session will address the topic sediment modeling, failure modes, and best practices. Stanford Gibson here has assembled representatives of, I won't say all of the popular sediment models out there, but certainly four of the top sediment models being used in the profession today. One point that Stanford made in putting this together is that model developers, unlike restaurant cooks, will eat their own cooking. And so they are not only model developers, they're model users. And so they're going to show us some of the inside baseball today about what to do and what not to do. And that's when we're talking about failure modes and best practices. So I think our first session focuses on pre-model.
All right, well, welcome everyone to what might be the first panel discussion at SEDHI. People can't remember another one, so we'll just claim it. My name is Stanford Gibson, and these are my friends. And we all develop sediment transport models, and I have learned a lot just from having conversations with these gentlemen. Over the course of years, by developing a model, yes, we do eat our own cooking, we do use our model, but we also see a lot of models that other people do. Sometimes people do things with their models that seem kind of creative and innovative, but often people are doing things with their models that make us shake our head a little. And when we get together, we find that we've had the same experience and have often learned things independently. And I've learned so much from having conversations with these guys that I thought, you know, it'd be really useful if other people overheard these conversations. And I thought, well, let's try that. And so here we are. We're going to have some conversations on some topics, and we're going to start with pre-modeling practices. This is one of the things that we all have in common. One of the topics that we found when we talk to each other is that before you even open the model, there are some things that we all do. And so let me just start by asking you guys, what are some of your pre-modeling practices? What are some of the things that you do before you even open the model?
Well, first of all, thanks, Dan, for organizing this. And I start our trainings usually with this, is understanding what the question is. What's the goal? What are the objectives of your study? And that sometimes is often the hardest part. Don't underestimate the time it takes to do that. You understanding it, the client understanding it, the stakeholders, like everybody, right? Everybody has to understand what are we hoping to get from this exercise. It has to be very specific. I mean, it can't be too general. And I think from this conference, hopefully you've been exposed to the wide variety of questions one can ask with a sediment model. And by model, I think we're loosely defining it as 1D and 2D, but you've also seen that there's mixtures of this. There are less than a 1D. There's all sorts of ways to analyze sediment, right? And so I think in modeling, I think we're also meaning not just 1D and 2D. There's a model could be a simple empirical formula. So that's a model of your system, right? So first, understand what you want to get and all the people involved on it, what you want to get. And understand that perhaps one model can't do everything you want, and you're going to use multiple methods, multiple things to get to that objective.
Yeah, I think it's good to provide context here. We're not talking about modeling for academic purposes. You know, we're talking about engineering models that want to answer an engineering question, right? You want to answer the question with the least amount of effort. And so defining the objectives is super important because you want to satisfy the project needs, but the goal is not to develop the best model possible, you know, with the highest resolution and all the bells and whistles, because we have timelines and budgets, and so that's very important.
Yeah, I think that model is not a self-defining term. I think that in general, when you walk into a room with other stakeholders, they'll say, well, there's a sediment problem, so we need a sediment model. And I think the question that I want to ask is, yeah, but what do you want me to model? Because there isn't a model I can make of this system. Mm-hmm. I want to know, what's the question you want me to answer? Because that will define like my model domain, my model selection, my data choice, what kind of calibration I do, all of those things.
Yeah, I find, you know, on any project, I try to not say anything a lot at the beginning. And I listen to as many people as I can, local knowledge, because very often people have very specific knowledge that they're not thinking about it in terms of sediment processes, but they're thinking about it in terms of the problem they have. So the first thing you understand is, what is the problem they have? And is it something that can be solved? Because ultimately, I think your responsibility is to solve the problem. And you're hoping to develop models that help you do it. But ultimately, you still have to solve the problem. You have to provide an answer. So it's just kind of a lot of listening and trying to narrow the problem down.
Yeah, often I see that people say, well, we'll just develop the model first and then figure out how to address the question later. But I think that's a little bit backwards. You know, you need to have the questions and the objective first, because that informs a lot of the modeling decisions from your domain, the extent of your domain to the model setup and the amount of runs that you're going to do and all that, obviously.
Yeah, and data collection, too.
Yeah.
What you're providing to the data. And then there's another underestimated task is understanding the limitations of each approach. And that's just a matter of a lot of education. And that takes actually a lot of time. And I mean, going to these conferences, seeing what people have done, what their results are, the limitations of approaches, right? So without understanding the limitations of your approach, you don't understand what it can do, right? So another thing I always want to point out is that understanding limitations of the approach is the key to really the successful implementation of that method.
Yeah, I think there's a question that I try to ask before I ask the question, what kind of model do you need, is can a sediment model offer value here, right? Or are you better off with an expert elicitation? And so when someone calls me and tells me about their sediment problem, I have a like a meter going off in my head of percentage chance I'm going to provide value with my model. As they're talking about their process, I think, is this a process that a model is good at? Or is it a process that a model is going to struggle with? So there's a podcast I listen to on writing, and one of the writers who shares in this podcast is a marionette, or I guess, is that the person who runs the puppets? I don't know. But she says that the only competition in marionetting is a bad marionette, because if you go to a bad marionette show, you're not going to another one. Right. And so she wants all of her colleagues to be great at this because she wants to kind of everyone be interested. I kind of think that the only competition in sediment transport is bad sediment transport modeling, because if someone talks you into a sediment transport model and it doesn't provide you value, you're not going to ask that question again. And so really deciding, do I even need a sediment transport model, or is that going to provide me value, or should I call David Biedenhorn and have him come look at the river?
Yeah, I always tell anyone who starts working for us when I'm trying to talk to them, first thing I tell them about the numerical modeling in general is paranoia is your friend, which is you don't want to hear because it's nerve-wracking, but that's the truth. You want to be paranoid, and skepticism is your friend. You should initially be your one worst skeptic. The one thing I've found a lot of times is in projects, there's an evolution, and initially I am the worst skeptic. But by the end of it, if I've come up with a product that I believe in, then there will very often be things that it tells people that they didn't expect, and I'll be insistent at that point. It's like, no, I can't find a reason why this is wrong. This is telling us something we need to look into. So it does add value, because it's one of the great things about a model is ultimately it can teach you things you don't know. It can also be, it's like trying to build a jigsaw puzzle, and then all of a sudden you've got the box. The model can give you a sense of what all these people have been telling you, and it integrates that information. But that's the end of the process. Yeah. Beginning, you're being very skeptical and limited in scope.
And as far as pre-modeling things to do, obviously you want to learn as much about the project site as possible, look at literature, talk to local experts about the site, visit the site. That's hugely valuable. One of the really useful outcomes of a modeling study is not just the model itself, it's the modeler, because they learn so much about the system when applying the model, right? And that's kind of the difference between visiting and not visiting the site also. Like, the person that has visited the site has so much more intuition and feel about the site. Yeah. So that's really a valuable thing to go visit the site.
That's one of the big things that I try to explain in sense of expectation, is that when you kind of commission a model, you're going to get two results. You're going to get a model that gives you results and answers to four significant figures, even though it's probably not accurate to the first one. But the second thing you're going to get is a modeler who has run 500 calibration runs and now has internalized what is sensitive and what is not sensitive in that system. And so, yes, when John Shelley builds a model of the Missouri River, like, I believe what his model says to a certain extent, but you can also pull him into a room, ask him a question about the Missouri River now, and he could tell you just out of his intuition, because he's internalized those sensitivities and dependencies.
Another important aspect, which just dovetails with this, is, you know, if you're going to develop a model, you need to have data in order to quantify it and to demonstrate your confidence in. And we're going to talk about that more later. But if you know on the front end what your limitations are, then that gives you a sense of what I'm going to be able to accomplish regardless. But the other thing is if you have an opportunity on the front end, very often data collection is kind of happening at the same time you're developing the model. Find the data collection people and go ahead and specify, I need these data. Please go get these data. Don't just collect a random set of data because it's sediment. And we can talk about that more later, but anything you can do in the front end to insert in that process would be good.
That's right.
Yeah. And take training and learn about the model as much as possible. You know, I think there's a hesitation of people to really get into the theory and the details about the models. And maybe you can get away with some of that for hydraulics, but for sediment, there's just too many methods, too many options. And you really have to. It's going to sound bad. People are going to hate me for this, but I don't think you can be better than a mediocre modeler if you don't know the theory to some degree. It's just not, you can't, you know. So you have to do that. Maybe it's not fun. You don't like to do that, but it's really important because that's what tells you, you know, the relations between different variables. You know, does this transport function even include a critical shear stress, for example? Maybe here you are, you know, adjusting your mobility factor. Nothing's happening. Well, it's because you didn't go look at the theory, you know. Yeah. This is really important. And so before you get into the modeling, if you haven't done one in a while, it's a good thing to do to go look at the technical reference document, look at the, you know, documentation for the model.
Right. I'm Young's here, but, like, I mean, read the user's manuals, the Young's of us. So it's simple. But, yes, that's always a thing. Another, I think we've talked about this a little bit, but, like, developing a conceptual model of the system, and that can be done with modelers. It should also be done with other people familiar with the area. So a geomorphologist is obviously, we have a good representation of geomorphologists at this conference, but a little bit underrepresented from engineers probably, but involving a morphologist if necessary, right? Into developing that conceptual model of system, again, that drives what processes are important. What do I expect to happen? Like I always say too, if you don't know what to expect, the model's not going to tell you. You need to know what to expect so you can represent that process, whether, you know, incision process after dam removal, you know, fines dumping into gravels or being flushed from gravels. Like, what is the process you're trying to represent? What is the conceptual model of that process, you know? And whether pictorial, even just write it out, right, or something that describes that, what you expect.
So on the topic of conceptual model, I do think that we need to think about it a little bit more like scientists. There's a senior practitioner in our field, I won't name him, but he retired from federal service and got a job in the private sector where he was mentoring 20 young modelers. And he said, "You guys, man, your program's too much like a video game. And all my young modelers, they're trying to win RAS. And they're just pushing buttons, trying to win RAS. And I can't get them to develop and test a hypothesis." We've forgotten how to develop and test a hypothesis. You should never open your model until you have a hypothesis about what the system's going to do. That's your conceptual model. Now, it might be wrong, and that's why we model it. And the most fun times are when you're wrong. And like what Gary said, we get to the end and says, "Listen, this is not what we thought was going to happen, but now I stand by it because I've tested the parameter space, and hopefully I have a story to explain it." And then one step below conceptual model, once you have a testable hypothesis, I said this very strongly when I gave my Snake River dam removal model, don't you dare start modeling until you've built your sediment budget. Because you're going to put in your internal fluxes and your external fluxes and try to model to some sort of bed change. And if your sediment budget doesn't balance on a napkin, it's not going to magically balance in your model. And what you'll do is you'll be like, "Oh, I'm not calibrating. I'm going to change my N value. I'm going to change my reference shear. You need more mass." And so don't even open your model until you've defined the question, you have a conceptual model, and you have a sediment budget.
You cannot start sediment until you have a good hydraulic model. As far as like pre-sediment modeling goes, that's really critical. The bar for a good model for hydraulics is higher if you're doing sediment. It has to be a lot better. Resolution, you know, just matching water levels. If you're doing a hydraulic model and calibrating the water levels, that's not enough for sediment.
You have to have a way to validate your velocities. And if you're doing a multidimensional model, like Alex and I work on, spatially validate velocities, because to all the transport is around that, but shear stress scales is the square of the velocity. So it's very, very sensitive to that. And it's necessary. You're not going to have a good sediment model if you haven't done that. So
we're moving on into the second phase. So now we're going to quote Thomas's Law. If you've been around the track a couple of times, you probably had the privilege to work with Tony Thomas or to sit at his feet. And Thomas's Law is that without calibration, a sediment model is not a model. It is a numerical experiment. So we're going to talk about model calibration and evaluation next. So,
all right. So Tony Thomas says that if you don't calibrate your sediment model, you don't actually get to call it a model. And so, gentlemen, what is interesting or different about calibrating a sediment model compared to hydraulics? Say you were coming in from hydraulics, you have experience calibrating a hydraulic model. What do you need to know when you move to sediment?
The complexity of sediment, the inherent complexity of it, is that we model it as in an Eulerian sense, But in reality, we have a gradation of sediment. The gradation responds differently. The gradation is a continuum, but we tend to model it discretely.
Yep.
When we model sediment, all models that I know of, most of them consider sediment, consider that someone has sieved it or created gradations, and we model those grains discretely because basically they behave discretely. You know, the easiest way to think about it is a depositional fan where you have fining at distance, and that has to do with the settling velocity. That's a fundamental thing, but armoring, all the processes have to do with discrete behavior. And then cohesive sediments are in some ways more complicated because we model those discretely, but they also stick together and they bind together in the bed. So you're increasing your dimension of your physics quite a bit. And another aspect is that sediment beds are the history of the river, mm-hmm. or the history of the environment. And so if there's some change in the bed, there's a lot of sorting that goes on, but there's also a lot of heterogeneity that comes along with that. And that influences the transport. So you just have a lot more complexity. And that's part of the reason why we want to be sort of humble in what we can accomplish with our models, because we're just jumping in. Even if you're modeling a 1D model over a long period of time, you're still modeling a small period of time relative to the history of that river. Some of the things that you want to do when you're looking at calibration of a sediment model is look at the data that you have, all the data you have, and recognize that that represents sort of a bound of what you're going to be able to say with the model. You don't calibrate to that, say that you have a calibrated model, and then answer any question you want. You calibrate to the data that you have, and then you can answer questions that are within the bounds of that calibration. So, for example, if you're doing dredging, you need to have calibrated to some dredging event.
John Shelley and I had that experience. We built this 350-mile model of the Missouri River that was just as dialed in as it could be. It was so pretty for a 350-mile calibration. I've never seen anything like it. And then 2011 happened, and we're like, oh, cool. That's a flood. It was a massive flood. Let's put it in the model. And we weren't even close. Not even close. And so making sure you're, A, using your model within the range in which it was developed, but then B, trying to use multiple time series and multiple conditions to test its resilience is really important.
Yeah. And I think one point is that there's not a unique calibration. There isn't probably even a best calibration. There's a range of possibility in your parameter set, and that's the best way I think about it. Is that there is observational error, right? There's error in the model, right? So don't think of it as coming up with the best Manning's in. There's a range of possibility, even when you have a calibration data set, and that error is going to be inherent. You're never going to nail that down to whatever digit you want, right? So even when you have a calibration, remember there's going to be parameter uncertainty mm-hmm. in your estimate. I mean, Manning's in changes, even if you had a good data set to calibrate to. The reference shear stress, there's probably a range that could fit the data reasonably well and still meet your error criteria. And that gets to the point of not over-calibrating, and we'll discuss this more. You have to stick to a few parameters. And if you're outside of typical ranges, that could mean you have something wrong, for example, mass balance error or something else. Like if you're over-tuning, you're having to push this parameter outside of a typical range, be very, very careful with that.
Yeah, and to be more specific about sediment, I think, calibrating to sediment volumes mm-hmm. is more useful than actual bed elevations at specific points. And sometimes you need to be more creative, like defining polygons of certain features. Maybe your dune is the right volume, but it's out of place, mm-hmm. for example, your sandbar or whatever it is, So it requires just more flexibility than a hydraulic calibration.
So I guess the next question is, well, what do we calibrate to? In a hydraulic model, we calibrate to high water marks and velocities. What are some of the things that you, and I'll use the term calibrate or evaluate your model with?
Very often, especially if it's a bed material load model, the calibration ends up being a lot of the gradation of the material within the range, because I have samples of the material and I have a sense of what it is, but there is a range of that, and because there's some sensitivity to that. Those models are tightly coupled to the gradation. They're going to yield transport that's tied to that gradation. So that's one of the parameters I use, but I do think one of the things I find with calibration, especially if you're trying to do base plan comparisons, you're using physics-based models. It's not like a regression model where calibration is everything. A big part of it is more forensics.
Yeah.
You run the model, it's not working, and you say, what is it physically that I'm misrepresenting here? And it becomes sort of an investigation. And once you've tied all that down, then you can start doing calibration.
Yeah, I think that works very well in some cases. In some cases, I've seen that the variation in the samples is so big, that even for initializing your model, you have to kind of simplify that, reduce that initial bed gradations to get something meaningful. And the bed elevations, the morphology, I found really useful for calibrating the sediment model. Also transport rates, like you can, you know, lay out profile lines or transects across your river or different places and compute transport rates and compare those with a regional sediment balance model. That's very useful.
Yeah, so far we have some sort of bed change metric, which Alex said a lot of times, you know, when people are first modeling, they just look at the change in Thalweg. They think of distance. You know, Peter Wilcock has said, humans are really good at measuring distance and not much else. And so we want to look at the bed change, but this is a mass balance. You need to look at volume. You need to look at area change over distance or actual volume change to get it right. Because your Thalweg can change 3 feet, but it doesn't actually reflect your volume. Your Thalweg can erode, and your mass balance can be positive because you're depositing in the overbanks. So bed change is, for me, king. Bed change is number one. I want repeated cross-sections. If you call me and say, hey, I want you to do a sediment model, remember, I'm calculating, can I provide this person value? My first question to you is, do you have repeated cross-sections or bathymetry? If you say no, and that means having a baseline. You can go out and get another one, but you can't create a historical one. And then we have bed gradation. And then the two others that I do is concentration. If you have an internal or downstream concentration gauge, you can use that to make sure that you're maintaining the concentration. And then in 1D, sometimes we do specific gauge. If you don't have bed change elevation, you know, water surface at the same flow is a surrogate. So you look at the water surface at, you know, 5,000 CFS in 1958, and you look at the water surface at 5,000 CFS at 2002, and that becomes a surrogate for bed change. It's what we call specific gauge.
Yeah, I think volume is one most common. And I think, I don't know, maybe because I'm not influenced by Tony Thomas, I'm a little, I would say, not so inherently saying that calibration is a requirement of a sediment study. I mean, so
Tony was my mentor, so you're allowed to think differently.
I won't take it that far. I would say if Stan says no, especially now, I'll say yes. Right?
I'm very happy with that situation.
but there, sometimes you have to be a little bit creative because the data is limited, right? So you aren't going to have as much data as you want, right? So you have to be a little bit more creative in the calibration state. For example, you need your model to reflect equilibrium conditions. And so calibrating to no change is calibrating, right? And so sometimes your system isn't stable and you're going to impose your project on that system. And so you're going to build a dam, for example, no one here is building dams, but you, in theory, that would be a problem, right? You have a stable river, you're going to put some structure in, right? You have enough knowledge to know that river is relatively stable. So that model should reproduce that stable condition, for example, even if you don't have protection. So sometimes you have to infer what's been happening, and at least qualitatively, your model needs to reflect that.
Yeah. And not all model runs are like final production runs. A lot of modeling that we do is to learn about the system, to make a plan on how we're going to tackle the project. And for those runs, obviously, you don't have calibration data, maybe yet, because they're out collecting it. But those model runs are still useful because you're learning about the system, and they may help you inform data collection or, you know, the types of model runs that you decide to do for your project.
I'll second that. You know, these models, if you plan to run many more simulations than you're going to use, because sometimes you can get tunnel vision, you're struggling, you're like, I can't quite get this concentration right. Sometimes it's useful to hit the model with a hammer. Say, even if I got this right, am I even going to get close? Or maybe I can make all these adjustments, it's not going to make any difference. So do something physically unrealistic in your model, because you can. It's a model. You know, you can do whatever you want. Just create some situation, just something, anything, to see if you can disturb the situation that it's trying to get in. Because if you can't, then there's something more fundamental going on, and none of the calibration is going to help.
This is why I was really excited about this, because Gary and I have never talked about this, but stress testing your model is something I do all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think one of the things you're hearing is that, okay, I've been a little bit persnickety about your created bathymetry, right? But the reason we call this calibration and model evaluation is that sometimes you evaluate your model with qualitative data. So is Edmund here? All right, so we're doing a bunch of modeling on the Arkansas. We're modeling, how many miles are we modeling? 445 models. Miles. And in, well, but it's like 15 models or something like that. And we do not have time to calibrate these models. We do not have data. The data is coming in while we're modeling. And so Edmund said to me, hey, several years ago, we put in these three structures, and it went from us, you know, dredging how many times?
It was dredged 60 times. We put these things in. It's been clean since. So what we're going to do is we're going to build the model without the structures that better deposit. And with the structures, it better not deposit. And that becomes the parameterization for everything else. Is it calibrated? It is not calibrated. Do I have pretty good confidence in it to make decisions at the level we need to make decisions? I kind of do.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about how it's different and what we try to evaluate our model with. What are the most common data or parameters that you change to calibrate your model?
It can be problem dependent, of course, right? But in general, you have your hydraulic conditions, Manning's in, right? That's always going to be there. And then you're talking about, well, how much sediment's moving. Usually it's a transport function and the coefficients embedded in the transport function. For example, transport functions usually have embedded in them a relationship for reference shear stress, critical shear stress, or something that controls when particles move, right? And that's almost always a dominant parameter. And then how particles interact could be another dominant parameter in terms of how gravels affect each other, how sands or particles interact, right? Focusing on those three, that's the go-to, for me, a go-to, right? You know, we've, of course, done more detailed studies on, you know, listing these, and for whether it's depositional or erosional makes a difference, too, in that response. Depositional model, well, it could be fall velocity, for example. It could be a dominant parameter in terms of how fast it falls out in your reservoir. So these can be variable, but there's going to be rules of thumb. What is the dominant process? If that dominant process in my model, what are the parameters that control that?
Yeah, it's very problem specific, like you said. Like, there's a big difference whether you're in a mountain stream or coastal estuary. Obviously, it's also model specific. Whether you're doing 1D RAS or 2D RAS or ADH, we have different formulations and different knobs. You know, as far as like transport scaling factors or whatever. I mean, this goes back to what I was saying in the beginning that you need to learn about the model that you're going to use before you start modeling. And as far as the things that I like to do, the first things I go to, like you were saying, is you want to make sure you're moving enough sediment, right? So that goes into your critical shear stress and your maybe scaling factors or coefficients in your transport functions. Once you're moving enough sediment, then look at your erosion and deposition rate. So maybe like in RAS, we have adaptation coefficients and things related to that. And that helps you kind of get the right shapes of intensities of erosion and depositions. Then after that, I look at bed gradations. And so hiding and exposure corrections and things like that really control a lot the interactions between particles and obviously the amount of erosion deposition that you get in different areas.
One thing I would say is that, you know, the higher order the model you have, the less room you have for calibration in a way. So in a 1D model, you're necessarily lumping cross-sectional properties into the model. But in multi-D models, you're doing less of that. 2D, you're lumping in vertical processes. In 3D, you're not so much. Because I find that most of my calibration process is really a little more forensic. What am I doing wrong? What am I missing in the hydrodynamics? What am I missing in the real world? And ultimately, either I'm successful or I discover that my model has limitations that are not going to help me get to where I need to go. There's something, I'm running a hydrostatic model, there's some non-hydrostatic behavior that's causing the problem. So it gives me more of a parameter of what I'm limited to. There's some sensitivity testing I can do to try to figure out, based on the information I have, what's the range of expectations I have. But I feel like I don't have as much room to calibrate because of that, because I've got a higher order physical system, so...
Yeah, in a 1D model, what I'd really encourage you to think about as a 1D model is a 1D model is a slightly sophisticated sediment budget, right? We're just moving flux around. And so I tend to mainly calibrate my flux. What's coming in and what are the grain sizes? And I always ask myself this question. What are the most sensitive, most uncertain parameters? So if you get a report from me, I made a visual aid that no one can see, but it's a 2x2 matrix, and on top it has higher sensitivity and lower sensitivity, and on the bottom it has higher uncertainty and lower uncertainty. And I put all of my data and parameters into those boxes, and I try to limit it to 2 or 3 parameters in this lower box of high uncertainty, high sensitivity. I fix my other parameters. And those are the ones that I change. And often they're the flux or the flux gradation. And this is where you get into what we call equifinality errors. If you're trying to tune too many parameters at the same time, you'll jack one of them way up and one of them way down, and they'll overcompensate for each other. And your model will calibrate, but it'll calibrate for the wrong reasons and perform very poorly outside of that range.
Session 3 is what we're about to move into now. And this is the title track for the album here.
Yeah, so that's right.
Failure modes and best practices. If you attend this session, then you get a coupon that will allow you to save money, because you will find that there are some things you want to avoid that will be time bandits that will suck the life out of your project, blow your budget, and make your supervisor very unhappy. So what we're going to have, things to avoid and then best practices. So
I think we learn best by counterexample. And so one of the things I just wanted to ask these guys is, tell me the good, the bad, and the ugly of what you've done and seen in sediment models. What are some sediment modeling failure modes? Or if you're a glass half full kind of person, you know, the opposite side of sediment failure modes are best practices. Not only what shouldn't you do, but what should you do? So what are some common failure modes or best practices that you see or recommend?
The most common failure mode that I see is people doing too much too quickly. In terms of model complexity, you want to take baby steps in your sediment model. Obviously, you need to start with the good hydraulic model first before you do sediment. But when you start doing sediment, you want to start with the simplified model and then maybe fixed bed model and look at your concentrations. And if that looks reasonable, then you do mobile bed and that kind of thing. And all of our models have many options and features, right? You don't want to turn every little feature on for your first run. Kind of start with the simplified model and then introduce complexity as you go. During that process, you're going to learn about what the different features do. Because I often see that people will just jump into the deep end, turn everything on, make it the most complex, use 20 grain classes and something like that, super high resolution. They wait over the weekend for their first bad model results.
Yeah.
And then they get disappointed. They think, I'm never going to get a result for my project.
Incremental complexity. That's the principle. That's the best practice. Because you have all these data. You're excited to use them. You want to put them all in. You're hoping to get an answer soon because your timeline's way too short. You're going to get an answer much sooner if you start with a very coarse time and spatial scale. You add a couple of variables, because each thing you add, then you learn its sensitivity. Whereas if you add them all at once, five things are going wrong and you have no idea which five out of the 35 are going wrong. And so incremental complexity.
One of the big things is getting the hydrodynamics right. And a multidimensional model, that has a lot to do with being very careful with the physics of the flow. And very specifically, one of the things that people tend to do, especially coming from the 1D world, is to use sort of eddy viscosity or mixing as a stabilization parameter. Eddy viscosity is basically supposed to represent the energy loss for anything smaller than the resolution of your model. It has a physical meaning. But any advection scales that you want to resolve, you need to put in there. If I have an eddy behind a dike and I have a huge cell there, if I put a big eddy viscosity in there, I can get the energy loss right and get the head loss right, but I won't resolve an eddy. You won't see it. You have to have enough resolution there that you can actually capture it. And you should do, there's the old grid resolution test on it. You double the resolution and see how much the answer changes. If it changes significantly, you didn't have enough resolution. So you want to resolve the features properly, and of course, you want to have as much data as you can to try to understand what those are. But even in the places where you don't have data, the hydrodynamics is essential, and I'm speaking very much from a multidimensional model world. I mean, it's true in...
I'll second you from 1D.
Right. It's absolutely true in 1D, but in 1D, if you get the profile right, you're doing pretty good because you're getting the energy losses right. But in 2D, that's the first order thing, but that's the reason you're running a multidimensional model. If you didn't need it, you wouldn't be running
it.
So you need to get that information as best you can.
Yeah, and I think it also goes back to the first session where we talked about problem definition. I think often you've won or lost right at the beginning.
That's right.
In terms of scoping, right? So never underestimate scoping and planning and getting the right tool for the job, the right budget, everything. And to get review of that, right? So I think a practical point is that usually you've set yourself up right from the beginning. But then secondly, I think incremental complexity is, you have to do it that way, adding one thing at a time so you know where something breaks. And then, again, back to our point of understanding limitations. Going into modeling right away, I wanted my 1D model to represent main channel and floodplains kind of distinctly and represent what happens in reality. Well, you know, I had to give up on that and like just say, no, you know, it's not possible. There's too much. Now, maybe there's a little bit of inference you can have, but you just aren't representing that. And it gets to understanding limitations. And so now I'm a lot happier rather than going high expectations and not meeting them, right? Low expectations and you meet them and you're totally satisfied.
What's model preconditioning and how do you do it?
That's a term that we often call preparing the bathymetry for the model. Often your initial bathymetry will have bed forms that are not represented in your model, will maybe represent a mixture of surveys from different time periods that maybe are not that great, but that's all you have. And so you start with that. Maybe your bed gradations have a lot of variability and you kind of chose something in the middle, but maybe it's not a great estimate. And when you precondition your model, you're removing the effects of those initial estimates for the bed elevations and your bed gradations and moving them towards something that the model is happier with. And so in doing so, you're removing the effects of the initial bathymetry and sediment gradations. Because if you don't, then what you'll see is that when you start your model, you'll initially see a lot of bed change and see large changes in your bed gradations, and then they'll slow down. And you're trying to remove that initial period of large change in your preconditioning so that when you compare like final minus initial, it's not huge. It's something more reasonable.
We have these beds that we're operating on that have a history that got laid down through various flood events. And we are trying to create a model. We're going to have some assumption of it. So you're absolutely right. You want to run the model until you see fluxes stabilize. But one of the things you'll see, I know you've seen in our code, probably in your codes too, you'll see every time you get a new version, you're like, hey, look, there's a new way to initialize the bed. and that's partly because we're trying to figure out, it's hard. You want to initialize gradation without changing elevations. Like we had a method where you wouldn't change the elevation, but then we realized we were trying to conserve mass, so it was pulling features that were submerged up to the surface. And, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff like that, right? So, and that is a pitfall because people not being aware of that will say, they will run the model and they'll look at all this deposition I'm getting. Yeah. And it's like, well, yes, but that's because it hasn't stabilized yet.
Gary, you influenced the way I think about this because you described it as, you know, we have a transport function and a sediment flux and a bed gradation. And I tended to think about those as three different things that I put in my model. But the way that you described it to me is that those are actually all one system that work together. And the chances of us getting them right in equilibrium from t equals zero is zero. And so the model needs some time to like warm up. We can change some of those so that they're closer, but the model needs time to bring those into convergence so that our bed gradation and our flux and our transport function are all working together in a model of reality. And so if you don't precondition your model, we end up with like, oh, look, there's a bunch of erosion. Yeah, but when did it happen? Well, it all happened in the first 10% of my model. Well, that's not real erosion. That's actually the model just trying to find its way to some sort of realistic state.
One thing I will say, too, though, we have failed with is underestimating the role of things that our models are not designed to do. So an example in 2D modeling, we're usually running hydrostatic models, and we know there's non-hydrostatic processes, local scour taking place. But we try not to solve problems that rely on local scour. But we found recently that the local scour issues propagate into morphology is chaotic. If you find a channel and it selects that channel, it can go off. If you don't know that it's chaotic, try to build a delta sometime in a lab or something like that. You know, these small perturbations can create problems, and that's something we have to be aware of.
This initialization, people do have different strategies, and I think one strategy is a model zeroing idea in terms of you run it until equilibrium. Now, that equilibrium could be different, a different system than what you have, right? But that's one strategy. Very common situation with this problem is in a 1D model and also 2D, right, where you have a complex pool riffle system, meandering river with a pool riffle system. Very common feature, right? Well, neither 1D or 2D actually are good at doing that because pool, it's a 3D phenomenon keeping that up, right? So your model limitation is that you aren't going to represent pool scour very well in 1D or 2D. Your model will, like, keep filling these pools. Right. So one thing is sometimes you have to run the model to fill the pools, right, is one way to get rid of that is you just fill them, right, so that you aren't trying to represent that. Or you just don't start with them to begin with.
That's right.
Just simplify a reached average sort of approach in terms of the cross-section or put cross-sections where there aren't pools. And then it would speed up the time it takes to reach that. But, you know, pool riffles is a very common failure mode is trying to replicate those with a 1D or 2D model. And so that's a huge limitation.
I remember the first time I ran a model of the Sacramento River, I thought, oh, look, the Sacramento River is unstable. The low places are becoming high and the high places are becoming low. That's what a 1D or even a 2D model will predict, is that your pools have lots of area, therefore they're going to deposit, and your riffles or your runs are going to erode. And almost every model will predict that because it's three-dimensional forces that are keeping those pools open. And so you need a modeling strategy that will keep those pools open, either by skipping them or making them pass through or taking them out. So the core actually has a stage calibration approach as well. And I think this is worth saying that, you know, this was Tony Thomas and Ron Copeland that came up with this, is that you think about, you have two variables. You have hydraulics that are variable and you have bed that's variable. And in the spirit of incremental complexity, you actually want to calibrate with incremental complexity as well. So you want to start with a steady flow, fixed bed calibration. Then you want to have an unsteady flow, fixed bed calibration. Then you want a steady flow mobile bed model testing. And this is the step that Ron Copeland and Tony Thomas really came in on that is maybe sometimes missed, is people go right from unsteady flow fixed bed to unsteady flow mobile bed. But you want to actually look at, how does your model respond to the bank full flow? Put in the bank flow. I mean, the whole idea of a channel forming discharge is that you give us a whole range of flows and it reproduces the morphology. Is that remotely true? And I think that goes back to model evaluation, that if your channel is in equilibrium, you should be able to kind of model a bank full flow equilibrium state.
That also goes back to increased complexity a little bit at a time. That's a very good point.
That brings us to the end of section three. We move on to session four, that's going to have your questions at the end. But before we get to your questions, we're going to talk about forecasting. Just check with Google, and they're not sure whether it was Niels Bohr or Yogi Berra that first said, all prediction is difficult, especially about the future. And so, the same is true, I think, of sediment modeling. So we're talking about sediment forecasting and then wide open Q&A.
So I ran the topics by some modelers, and it was John Shelley who said, because I had best practices and failure modes in two different sessions, and he said, those are the same thing. I want to hear about what you do once your model's calibrated. How do you actually solve a problem with a calibrated model? And so let me just ask you guys, once your model is calibrated, what are some of the distinctive things you do to either forecast the future or evaluate alternatives?
Yeah, I'll start with two things. One is typically you're always comparing to a baseline, no action. Like a forecast without context may not be that meaningful, right? So you need a run, let's say, that without that project you're doing or something to provide context to that forecast, one thing. And the other gets back to my point of that there isn't a unique calibration. There's a range of possibility of your parameter set. Use that range of possibility in your parameter set. One estimate of your model uncertainty is to, you know, run that range of parameters within your model, and it could be a couple, you know, two, three, maybe up to three. Don't do many, too many.
Yeah.
You know, three different parameters that you're varying, you know, maybe, you know, together, individually and together, to see what the range of possibility is. There's statistical ways to do it if you're so inclined. But you don't give them one answer. Just give them, like, at least a range of possibility.
I used to say something, and now I'm very cautious about saying it, but now this is going to be recorded, maybe I'll be less cautious. I used to say, anyone who gives you one answer in sediment modeling is being irresponsible. You should give a range of answers. Now, someone once stood up in a meeting and said, Stanford Gibson said, anyone who gives you a sediment answer is being irresponsible. That's not what I said. But I do think that you have to somehow communicate that this is a multi-parameter model that has much more uncertainty than the hydraulic folks are used to. And you need to somehow communicate that.
Yeah, and as is with most models, the uncertainty increases with the length of the time that you're predicting, right? And so if you're calibrating with, let's say, two surveys that were measured over a year, but you're trying to forecast 10 years, well, there's a lot of uncertainty in that, more than what you saw in your calibration data set. And besides that, you're also adding on to that the uncertainty of the forecast itself for the hydraulics, right, and hydrology. So yeah, there's just a lot of uncertainty, and that's why you need to provide more than just one answer, some kind of estimate of the uncertainty. And the different types of uncertainty, some of it like will be in the hydraulics and hydrology, some of it will be in the bed, and some of it will be structural, right? The methods that you chose to calibrate with and all of that. So you can do all that testing. That's very useful.
And there are just practical limitations to what you can do sometimes with 1D versus multi-D. Now, you can do more robust sensitivity and statistics with a 1D model, and that's part of the advantage to using them. With a multi-D, you can get more detailed answers, but sometimes the best you can do is a series of sensitivity tests perturbing the boundary conditions and seeing how it will go out in the future. A couple of things I was going to say. One, like in terms of sea level rise analysis, one of the things to keep in mind is that morphologic response is time-integrated response. So you can't just go 50 years in the future and raise the sea level and see what's going to happen. You have to find a way to integrate that through. But in terms of the actual response, you know, looking at uncertainty and how we adapt to that in terms of policy, the best model we have for that is how we do hurricane forecasting, because a hurricane forecast is basically just a series of multidimensional models that are a spaghetti plot, and they do statistics on what they have. But we have a very good public sense of the hurricane could hit somewhere between Key West and Panama City, and oh boy, now what are we going to do? And there's a series of responses to that. And so the more we can integrate that, the better. But of course, part of the issue is this is starting to multiply in your mind. How am I going to do all these simulations? And so I guess the best answer to that is whatever you're able to do is about the degree of confidence that you have. And sometimes if you can't do too much, you don't have a lot of confidence in the future. But one thing you do have is if you're just doing basic plan comparisons, if you can do that with multiple perturbations and you end up with the same response, then it gives you a sense that your base to plan is robust to that uncertainty. And that is good. If you can do that, then you can say, I don't really know what the future holds, but I know this little change is probably going to do something that I like. And so, you know, that's good.
So. And that's knowledge. So I have two other things. One is that I don't actually trust the results of most sediment models absolutely. If I tell you, you know, there's going to be 20 tons of sediment that deposits in the next 10 years, I don't feel like that's something I can tell you. What I can tell you is that this management action will cause a relative difference from another management action. And so I tend to try to describe my results in relative differences. And I try to set those expectations from the beginning. In the first call, I say, listen, I'm not going to tell you how much you need to dredge. I'm going to tell you the relative difference in dredging of your management actions. And it's going to be like a lot, or, you know, it'll be order of magnitude, but it'll be in relative differences. It won't be to 3, 4, or even 2 significant figures.
Yeah. And that's why it's very important from the beginning to define the objectives and the criteria that you're going to utilize to judge your project decisions. Because you may, after a certain number of simulations, determine that you don't have the uncertainty required to address your engineering decision, right? For example, if your water surface, you know, we're talking about sediment, but let's say some value is within a certain elevation or threshold, and that's within your uncertainty, well, then you need to reduce that uncertainty. But if it's very outside of that, you know, the range for that threshold, then you're done. And maybe a preliminary analysis is all that you need to answer that question. So defining the uncertainty from the beginning, the acceptable uncertainty is useful, and the objectives and the criteria, so that you don't get too far along also in your project and then realize, oh, actually the criteria that they want, the measure that they're going to use is this other thing. We can't address that with these simulations. We have to redo them all. And so that's a failure mode of projects as well. And it goes to the forecasting, right? The uncertainty in your forecasting is going to be a function of the quality of your calibration model.
Yeah, just because you're uncertain doesn't mean that you're wrong, right? So and you can be uncertain about it. You can be very uncertain, but you can still give very important, valuable information for your project.
Yeah.
Or not, depending on, again, your criteria that you need to meet, you know, for that answer.
The last thing I'd say about predicting the future, this is a trap that lots of folks fall into, is that they calibrate their model without reference to what they're going to ask it to do. And then once they've got this beautiful calibrated model, now they're going to change the domain to add structures or something like that. And once they change that domain, their model is no longer calibrated. And so they have to go back in. So like, for example, we're adding linear structures on the Arkansas. And so before I calibrate my without project conditions, I'm going to put those structures in and build my 2D domain around them and then take them out. So that when I'm calibrating my without project conditions, everything's the same except for those structures are going to go in.
The computational mesh resolution is the same with and without the structures.
That's right.
That's the main thing.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that that ends the formal content of the panel discussion, but I would like to invite Gary Brown to talk to us about model selection and finches.
Yeah, because we're often asked about which model should we use for sediment. And we were talking about this the other day, and I said, well, it's like asking which finch belongs in the Galapagos Islands. This is something a little beyond what we talked about, but all of us are at an age about 10 or 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, there was a lot of multi-grain model development going on in terms of sediment. And all of us were kind of working in our silos on that. And then there are several of you in the room doing the same thing. So that's the reason all these models exist. They kind of developed in silos, and then they started to blend together. So then the question is, well, why don't we just have one? And the answer, part of the answer to that, I think, is that they have a history, they have a legacy, and they have the developers involved. And so you're able to use them, and people are able to utilize them. So there's a multitude of tools, but that's kind of why they exist. For a lot of applications, there's a tremendous amount of overlap and capability. And I don't think we know a lot of detail about each other's models that well. We have a general idea, but we work in our realms pretty exclusively. What we recognize, we see that we're solving a lot of the same problems, and actually there's sort of a convergent evolution on how you solve them. If you look under the hood, a lot of how we solve them is similar, and we didn't talk to each other on the front end sometimes. It just worked out that way. So I guess the best thing to do is look at the capabilities of the models. A model that you are comfortable with, that you can use, and that you are confident that you can get the answer with is a good model to use. But it's very rare that there's going to be an obvious choice among the models that we have that says this is the one you need to use.
For me, it's kind of like the hydraulic models, right? Where there may be some clear-cut cases where maybe you need 3D. Okay, then obviously you have to use a 3D ADH, right? Or maybe it's a 1D problem. It's obvious. But there may be some gray cases where it could be either or. And in those cases, it may be subjective things like the experience of the person who's going to do the model in each model, right? If it's a power ADH user, then use ADH. If it's a power RAS user, then maybe RAS. You have to consider all those things in deciding.
I'd like to just say thank you. Thank you to the panel.
I'm not sure I've done anything at a conference that I've gotten more feedback on than that conversation. And I sure wish I could have listened to something like that about 20 years ago, but I'm glad it's available now. We did write a companion paper to this conversation in the SEDHI Proceedings, which I'll link to in the episode notes if you'd like a hard copy overview of some of these ideas. And thank you to Alex, Gary, and Blair for taking the time not only to do this, but to prep it, because a tight, high insight yield conversation like that doesn't happen by accident. Each one of them came to play, and they give a lot of thought to what to share and how to deliver it succinctly. I'd also like to thank Tim Randall and Jennifer Bountree and the rest of the SEDHI planning team. I know that presentation slots at that conference are premium, and spending four of them on an experimental session like this represented a significant trust on their part. Next week, we're going up watershed to the headwaters as we talk to Elaine Recking about high gradient river processes. Dr. Recking has explored high gradient sediment transport just about every way you can, with some important flume experiments, some instructive analysis of big data sets, and field experiments in the headwaters of the French Alps. These are informal conversations, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent the official positions of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or the offices or centers of the guests or host. Mike Loretto wrote the music for this season and edited and mixed this episode, which represents a significant effort with my first attempt at recording live five-channel audio. I'm Stanford Gibson, and this is the RSM River Mechanics Podcast, funded by the USACE Regional Sediment Management R&D Program. Thanks for listening.